The reading is from Luke chapter 9, starting at verse 18, which is on page 33. Luke chapter 9, verse 18. Now it happened that as Jesus was praying alone, the disciples were with him, and he asked them, "Who do the crowds say that I am?" And they answered, "John the Baptist, but others say Elijah, and others that one of the prophets of old has risen." Then he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered, "The Christ of God." And he strictly charged and commanded them to tell this to no one, saying, "The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and on the third day be raised." And he said to all, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in glory and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. But I tell you truly, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God."
Thank you, Rachel, very much indeed for reading for us. May I add my welcome to Mark's. May I encourage you to turn off your mobile telephone if you have one. I always find the best tactic if your telephone goes off in a meeting like this is to ignore it completely and look around as if it belongs to somebody else. I recommend that. Now, our subject this afternoon is discipleship, and we're going to look at what I call in inverted commas the cost of discipleship. And we're going to look at the benefits of discipleship. And we're going to see that true disciples of Jesus yield authority over their lives to Jesus Christ. True disciples of Jesus yield authority over their lives to him. And it's always helpful to know what the aim of a talk is. My aim this afternoon is what I think Luke's aim in recording this incident for us, that you and I surrender to Jesus Christ. Let me say, I want us to yield not reluctantly, not begrudgingly, not half-heartedly, not with a secret arms cache still hidden away just in case we decide to resume hostilities at a later date, and not with our fingers crossed, but gladly and extravagantly and joyfully, wholeheartedly and willingly. I've been preparing this talk while stuck in Cape Town awaiting for the dust to settle, as it were. It was not an unduly arduous experience. But as I sat there waiting for aeroplanes to fly again, it struck me just how little control one really has over one's life. The same thought occurred to the Times columnist Janice Turner, stuck in New York, who wrote, "I hate this purgatory, this surrender of control over my life to that unheeding, capricious creep, nature." And it struck me that my control over every aspect of my life is considered to be a virtual human right in our culture, which is probably why the last 2 weeks have been so difficult for so many people. It is, of course, a very Western and very middle-class point of view. It's only the most privileged who live in the bubble of delusion that we control our lives. And what I wanted to see this afternoon is that we do not ultimately control our lives. And therefore it is the wise and the most profitable thing to yield control of our lives to Jesus now rather than when we have to. The passage we're studying comes at the end of a major section of Luke's Gospel on the identity of Jesus. The section begins in chapter 7, verse 1, and ends in chapter 9, verse 51, which is where we'll be going in this series, of a short series, a shortened series of three. And I guess the writer Luke might have finished the section when Peter announced, "You are the Christ of God." Identity done. But Luke doesn't finish the section there. Unlike our prospective prime ministers, he wants us to know in detail what it will mean if we actually end up with Jesus in control of our lives. And so we have these three sections, this little section at the end of the section on the energy of Jesus on discipleship, what it's actually going to look like if we yield control, so that we're in the clear and we're not completely surprised on the 7th of May, as it were. If you are to follow me, then, Jesus says, it will cost you everything. If you fail to follow me, it will cost you everything forever. If you follow me, it will be for your everlasting, unending benefit. That's really where we're going today, the cost of discipleship. And I put it in inverted commas because actually it is no cost at all. Once Jesus' disciples have identified Jesus as the Christ in verse 20, Jesus goes straight on to explain that he must suffer in verse 22. Peter answered, "You are the Christ of God." Verse 21, Jesus strictly charged and commanded the disciples to tell this to no one, saying, "The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and on the third day be raised." That title that Jesus uses for himself so often, the Son of Man, is the most exalted title he could possibly have chosen. It comes from the Old Testament, and the Son of Man is the one to whom God the Father delegates all his authority, all his glory, and all his power. The nature of the rule of the Son of Man is absolute. To him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom. The duration of the rule of the Son of Man is eternal. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that shall not pass away. His kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. And the extent of the rule of the Son of Man is universal. All peoples, all nations, all languages serve him. Now Jesus takes this title of absolute, eternal, universal rule and applies it to himself. And he says, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by elders, chief priests, and scribes, and be killed, and on the third day be raised. He combines the exalted title with the extraordinary work that he must accomplish on the cross in Jerusalem before his final exaltation. And I suspect in verse 22, when he talks about his suffering, there are deliberate allusions to the picture of the suffering servant with which any of us who've been around in Christian things will be familiar, that you find in Isaiah 53, where the suffering servant is described as being reviled and rejected by men. And it is the suffering servant who carries in his body God's judgment and God's just anger at the sins of the world. So then, no sooner have Jesus' disciples identified him as God's exalted king than Jesus spells out the mission of the exalted king, that he will go to Jerusalem, that he will suffer death on a cross, and then be exalted. He has come to suffer as a sacrificial offering in order to carry God's just judgment at your sin and mine. And so by his death, Jesus opens up a route back to God. Jesus washes us clean of all that we've done to offend God. Jesus deals with God's anger at our sin. Jesus restores us in right relationship with God. And Jesus gives us access to God and to his eternal new creation. The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. And it's in that context that Jesus then goes on to speak about the cost of discipleship. Verse 23, he said to all, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me." Now, we need to look in detail at a couple of little aspects of that verse that people often misunderstand. To deny yourself, the word means to disown, does not mean giving up one or two minor naughtinesses in Lent. You know, some people set themselves little targets in order to tackle their personal excesses and keep individual foibles in check. I will not eat chocolate for 40 days. No puddings for a month. Second helpings are out. The word to deny means to disown. And the model for denial is Jesus. Jesus does not go his own way, he goes God. Jesus does not seek his own glory, he seeks God. Jesus does not pursue his own agenda through his life for his good and his promotion, he seeks God's. From beginning to end of his life, Jesus' life was a life of self-denial, not just putting aside little foibles, there were none, but rather seeking God's glory, God's promotion, God's agenda, God's purpose and priority. Now, says Jesus, as he explains that he will be going to the cross in order to open up a route back to God for us, if you are going to follow Jesus, if I am going to follow Jesus, we must walk the same path. When Jesus talks about taking up our cross, he's not talking about putting up with life's little trials or our own burdens of health or family circumstance. I went on a long bus journey about a year ago and sat behind two fantastic granny age, East End grannies. And for anyone who's ever listened to Monty Python, it could have been John Cleese and Eric Idle. It was a long journey in the central London traffic, and the two ladies had patently known each other since childhood and been at school together, and we had spelled out for us 7 or 8 decades' worth of health history. Why the National Health Service needs to keep records, I can't imagine. They know absolutely everything about what's happened to them for every decade of their life, and now I do as well. At the end of the conversation, one of them turned to the other and said, I kid you not, well, Ethel, we've all got our cross to bear. Now, Jesus is not talking about that, your tennis elbow, or your arthritic knee, or your difficult mother-in-law who's come to live in the granny flat for the next decade. No, the cross was a state-sponsored tool of death. The cross in the first century was a means of killing criminals. And frequently, the man on his way to his death on the cross was given the center part of the cross to carry through the streets, a great wooden centerpiece, as a public example to everybody else, so that when you saw a man carrying, as Jesus did, part of the way, carrying their cross, there was only one conclusion you could draw. There's only one place this man is headed. To death. So says Jesus, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. This disowning of self and putting of self to death, of course, is the precise reverse of sin. And therefore, it's entirely logical if you think about it. Sin, an often misunderstood word, is me saying to God, I'll do it my way. It's the Frank Sinatra, the embodiment of the Frank Sinatra song that so coined the general ethos of our age. I'll do it my way. Those words, actually, are the oldest lyrics in the book. I'll do it my way is exactly what Adam and Eve said to God in the garden in Genesis 3. That's what caused the fall. Me doing it my way is what God hates. Me doing it my way is why God had to send his son to die on a cross. As the nails were driven into the hand of Jesus and into the feet of Jesus, as the spear was thrust into his side, and as God's wrath was poured out on Jesus, God's wrath was poured out on Jesus because I've done it my way. And he was carrying God's just judgment at my sin. And therefore, it's entirely right and logical. It stands to reason, doesn't it? That if I am going to follow Jesus, I will turn to him, yield myself to him, and say, right, this is an end to me doing it my way. I will disown myself now. That's what's taken you to the cross. That's what God hates. And I will now take up my cross daily putting myself, my desires, my dreams, my rebellious attitude, my rejection of God, my own personal autonomy to death, and I will follow you. Please note, this is not an optional affair. It does not apply simply to one or two super keen followers in the jet stream of discipleship. Look at verse 23. He said to all, if anyone. So this is not an optional affair. This is an every man, every woman, every child affair for anyone who wants to call themselves a disciple. Please note, this is not an occasional affair. It isn't something that you just do as a one-off, and then when you get to your middle life or your old age, you start saying, well, I'm going to start living for myself now. It's time to pamper myself a bit. No, he said to all, we should take up our cross daily. And so it's not an occasional affair, it's an everyday affair. Oh, says someone listening in, does this mean that we shall all be pre-packaged automata, making our way like brainwashed cult members, lemmings, through life? No, each one is to yield control of our lives to Jesus, our Creator. As we turn back to him, so we will be restored in relationship. And as forgiven members of God's family, he will make us into the people we were meant to be in the first place, with our personalities and our own individual personalities and characters and gifts, and the people now used in service of him. We will blossom and flourish, actually, as real human beings, rather than the brainwashed lemmings who wander through life rebelling against their Creator. Oh, says somebody else, does this mean that each of us is immediately to draft ourselves into overseas missionary service or gospel work on the sink estates of our urban centres? Well, not necessarily, but possibly. But each is to give ourselves to God, to deny self, to count ourselves dead to our own agenda and to our own self-service, and to take up our cross and to follow the Son of Man who gave his life as a ransom for us, out of his love for us. Why wouldn't you? When the King and Creator of the universe loves you so much as to give himself for you and to open up eternity, why wouldn't you? Speaking of overseas missionaries, a friend sent me through yesterday this quote. He'd been to the Livingston Memorial in Ballantyre, that's David, not Ken, of course, and the David Livingstone, the African medical missionary, has wrote this in his diary: I will place no value on anything I have or possess except in relation to the kingdom of Christ. Doesn't mean we all necessarily have to go and be overseas missionaries. But it does mean wherever God has placed me, in this office, this family, that neighborhood, I place no value on anything I have or own except in relation to Christ, my King. So there is, inverted commas, the cost. And already, I hope you see, it's not really a cost at all. I'm not sure it's right to call it a cost, though it is called a cost in the Bible in places. Well, you may say to yourself, hold on, William, this is far, far more than I ever bargained for when I agreed to come along on a Tuesday or a Thursday lunchtime. You know, it's one thing to make space in the day for a lunch hour or to cut short the Sunday morning lie-in and put off the Sunday papers till a little bit later, but this is more like sort of fundamentalist extremism. And so what I want to do now is to turn from the cost of discipleship to Jesus' explanation and the benefits, verse 24 to 27, and you'll notice that the argument is very tightly formed there, and each of the verses, 24, 25, and 26, begin with that little word, for. Verse 24, there's a promise. Verse 25, for, there's a persuasive question. Verse 26, 27, there is the perspective of eternity. The promise. For whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. Now, I think that looks quite enigmatic. It's quite hard to get hold of, isn't it? What does it mean to want to save your life? What does it mean to lose your life? And the key is in the second half of the verse. Look at it again. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. So then, for a person to lose their life is for a person to yield control of their lives to the rule of Jesus, to hand over the keys, to give him the reins, if you like. Not that I just wander through life as an automata, but I say, you are now the main authority, your agenda, your desire. And therefore, if I'm to save my life, it will mean me saying, I am not going to go on living my life with me as the ruling king, pursuing my agenda with no reference to Jesus. I will acknowledge Jesus and yield. And, says Jesus, such a person will save their life. Of course they will. Because I yield to Jesus, I find myself forgiven by God. And as I yield to Jesus and come under his authority, I find myself in the kingdom of God already. And as I yield to Jesus, I find myself now looking forward to eternity with God the Father as a forgiven person. Pardon, peace with God, purpose for eternity, a new power to battle with sin, God's presence in my life day by day, the people of God as my friends, brothers and sisters all around the world, and eternity to look forward to. I was preparing this last Tuesday, actually, thinking of you all here, as I sat in a house by the beach on the balcony in the sunshine near Cape Town. And I was with a really, really very good friend. And we were talking about this. And as we were chatting, he said to me, you know, William, won't the new creation be simply wonderful? You know, we're really great mates. We see each other about once every 5 years. And it's such fun when we see each other. And it's a joy. And then there you were looking out on False Bay. You know, there weren't whales, but there might have been whales in the bay. And, you know, won't the new creation be wonderful? Now, as we yield to Jesus, you see, that is all opened up to us, together with all the benefits of today, of God's people, brothers and sisters, of God's power to begin to battle with sin, and so on. But in the first half of the verse, verse 24, the person who wants to save their life is the person who says, well, I think actually I can get on with building my life without reference to Jesus. I don't want this authority over my life. I want to run my life my own way, thank you very much. And I guess we could quite easily picture a person sitting here saying that. Disown myself. Take up my cross daily. Follow Jesus on his terms, not mine. Yield to Jesus. Oh, that would be to return to medieval subjugation. It would be to give up my fundamental human right of self-determination. And Jesus says, if that is you, you will lose your life. And here's the persuasion of verse 25. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? What will it profit you if you gain all of your life? I mean, let's imagine that you're a bloke and you meet a girl and that she's the most beautiful, intelligent, articulate woman known to humanity. The brains of Nicola Horlick, the beauty of Cheryl Cole, the charm and elegance of Julia Roberts and the grace of Michelle Obama. And she's rich. And together, she likes you, you like her, you get married, you have 2.4 kids, they're intelligent, well brought up, good schools, they go to top universities, they have solid careers and they get well established, and you progress up the career ladder and you become, you achieve exalted status, top executive of a top FTSE 100 company, and then you secure a long and healthy retirement and you spend your winters on the ski slopes and your summers on the Mediterranean beaches. Ultimately, you will not go on forever. You are not really free. And you will end up in a little box 6 foot by 2. And if we've gained the whole world and lost ourselves, by failing to recognize the King who rules over eternity, what have we gained? Which is why Jesus, in the last two verses, takes us to the perspective of eternity. I remember meeting with a group of bankers, some of you here, that most of them were pretty senior men, very successful in the eyes of the city, and I said to them, what to you is the most costly aspect of following Jesus? And I was expecting to say all sorts of things about, you know, disowning self and denial of self and counting Jesus ahead of my ambition. It's very interesting. They were all blokes. To a man, they said, being known publicly as a Bible-believing Christian. The shame and the ignominy of it. Now look at what Jesus says. For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory. As we close then, I want to ask you to do something you're probably not asked to do very often in church. I want to ask you to imagine that you're having an out-of-body experience. Okay? It's not today, it's a few years down the track, and the scene is a crematorium. In the front row of the crem are all your loved ones, your wife, your children, your friends and family, and behind them are your colleagues and acquaintances, and there is a coffin. There in the crematorium is a coffin, and in the coffin is your body. And you are floating above. I don't actually believe this sort of thing happens, in case you come and talk to me afterwards. This is an outer cave. This is not my, you know, this is an imaginary picture, it's an illustration. You are floating in an out-of-body experience above your body. What have you got with you? Nothing. What have you got to look forward to? Well, there's just one appointment left. I mean, you haven't got your BlackBerry, but were you able to turn your BlackBerry on? There is just one appointment left with the Son of Man. The nature of his rule is absolute. God has given to him all authority, a kingdom and dominion. The duration of his rule is eternal, for everlasting. It's going to go on forever and ever. And the extent of his rule is universal. He died for you on a cross in 33 AD in a particular place at a particular time. He loves you. And if you and I have been so ashamed of him and of his words that we will not deny self and take up our cross but will insist on continuing in our sin, then in that last appointment, he will say, I'm ashamed of you. Let's pray together. I'm just going to use a very short prayer by David Livingstone. My Jesus, my King, my life, my all, I again dedicate my whole life to thee. You may like to echo it in your heart. My Jesus, my King, my life, my all, I again dedicate my whole life to thee. Amen.